Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the San Diego Performance Academy. Today, we're going to be devoting a good portion of our show to talking about the international crises unfolding in the Ukraine and Crimea, what the issues are and what the stakes are and why that's important to the rest of the world. So I'd like to begin by reading some of the timelines of these crises from today's Washington Post. President Viktor Yanukovych, who was ousted back in the Orange Revolution in 2004 and voted back in 2010, in November, he abandoned a deal that would have brought closer ties with the European Union in favor of aligning with Russia. A month later, in December, pro-EU protesters occupied the city hall in Kiev and took over Independence Square. In February of this year, at least 88 people were killed in 48 hours as it escalated into violence. And then on February 21st, President Yanukovych signed a compromise deal with opposition leaders, and the very next day he fled Kiev, and the parliament voted to remove him and set elections for May 25th. Then, a couple of weeks ago, on February 27th, 28th, pro-Russian gunmen seized key buildings in the Crimean capital. And on March 1st, the Russian parliament approved President Vladimir Putin's request to use Russian forces in the Ukraine. Then, complicating matters even more, on March 6th, Crimea's parliament asked to join Russia and set a referendum for March 16th to do so. So, a lot happening very fast in that part of the world. So today I've got two people with me in the studio. The first is our intern, Jessica Richmond, who is a political science major from San Diego State University. Jessica's been helping us research these issues, and I'm very pleased to have her on the show.
Thank you so much, Miriam. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning.
Very good. And our very special guest today is Professor Phil Pride. He is a professor emeritus, retired professor from San Diego State University. He has a PhD from the University of Washington in Soviet environmental problems, and he is the author of the book Environmental Resources and Constraints in the Former Soviet Republics. So he has a lot of expertise on this part of the world. Dr. Pride, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Miriam. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Can you start, Professor Pride, by giving us a brief history of Crimea, your area of expertise, and why it's more complex, as you say, than we've been hearing about in most of the media?
That's a very good place to start, because it is a fascinating history. There's probably very few, if any, areas on planet Earth that have a longer and more complex history than Crimea does. And it goes back to the first, let's say, outside settlers that came in there were actually the ancient Greeks. In the first millennium before the time of Christ, the Greeks moved in there. And a lot of the cities that are there are all in part Greek names that were given a long time ago. So I'm going to take about 30 seconds and just run through all the people who have lived in and controlled all or part of the Crimean Peninsula since about 1000 BC. Here we go. The Scythians, Greeks, Roman Empire, Goths, Huns, Bulgars, Khazars, Kievan Rus, the Byzantine Empire, the Mongols, even Genoa and Venice were fighting over it for a while. Crimean Tatars, a name you may not have heard that much about, that are extremely important to the area. The Ottoman Empire, the Russian Empire, independent for a few years at the time of the Revolution and Civil War, and then under the Soviet Union, Crimea was about half the time part of the Russian Republic and half the time part of the Ukrainian Republic, and then gained its independence, or Ukraine did, in 1991, at which time Crimea took on its current name, which is the Autonomous Republic of Crimea.
So turmoil is nothing new in this region.
Turmoil, but and also an extremely varied ethnic history. So it's not just Russians and Ukrainians there, although they are by far the majority people there. There's a lot of other people that have played a role there over the years.
Very good.
Can you elaborate on the strategic military interests present in the Crimean region of Ukraine, Professor?
In the Crimea, keep in mind that legally the Crimea is part of Ukraine at the present time. But ever since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, about the first thing that Russia did was to sign a long-term agreement with the Ukrainian government to maintain the major, probably one of two or three most important Russian naval bases at the big seaport and naval base center of Sevastopol. And that agreement, I believe, extends until the year 2045. And nobody is going to mess with that agreement. In addition, the same harbor at Sevastopol is also the headquarters of the Ukrainian Navy. Now, when you say those two terms, the Russian Navy is the 800-pound gorilla, and the Ukrainian Navy is, you know, kind of like a 10-pound pussycat in terms of their relative military power and influence there. So, but they both have the right to be there by treaty, but you've gotten some idea of just how serious the Russian government takes that by the fact that they scuttled one of their own ships to block the harbor so the Ukrainian Navy couldn't get out.
Wow.
So that gives you some idea of how things are playing out there militarily.
Well, that definitely puts it into perspective.
Now, Professor, does the U.S. have any strategic interest or resources present in the Ukraine?
We don't directly have anything really major. If we're talking about the Ukraine as a whole, then our primary interest is with our European allies because, as has been well pointed out in the media, Western Europe does get the majority, by far the majority, of its natural gas in particular, and probably a fair amount of petroleum as well, from Russia. And those major big pipelines, some of them at least, go through Ukraine. So in theory, and this is just hypothetically, Putin could shut off that natural gas supply just by ordering some valves to be turned. Whether he would do that is the $64 question. I tend to think he wouldn't, because that would be a crisis, you know, 10 times bigger than the current crisis.
Yeah, we'll talk a little further about that later, about what the ramifications might be if such actions
right.
were to happen.
Just to the other part of your question, is there any strong economic problems or connections with the Crimea? Pretty much the answer to that question is no. I don't think either Western Europe or the United States has any direct, significant economic interest in Crimea.
I'm wondering what your professional opinion is about the protests in the Ukrainian capital that led to this coup d'etat, the ouster of President Viktor Yanukovych. Was this a righteous people's revolution, or do you think there were some hidden agendas, some extremist groups involved in that?
Well, undoubtedly, it's a complex issue. Everybody that was demonstrating in the square and so forth probably had their own reasons for doing it, but the overall question was purely a question of the future of the country, of Ukraine, and whether it was going to be associated militarily, economically, and so forth, more closely with Russia or with Western Europe. And the Russian minority in Ukraine, of course, wanted it to be associated with Russia, as did Yanukovych. But the majority of the people in Ukraine were probably more interested in trying to become more closely allied with the European Union and have their connections, economic connections and agreements and so forth, more with the West rather than with Russia.
Right. And Yanukovych, of course, is aligned very much with Russia.
Yeah. So that was certainly by far the main question they were demonstrating for the future of their country and which major power group, so to speak, it would be aligned with.
Professor, can you elaborate on the ethnic makeup of Crimea? And subsequently, do you believe that there is any validity to the reports claiming that Vladimir Putin sent in troops to Crimea to protect the ethnic Russians?
Yeah, two questions there. Let me tell you what the makeup of the population in Crimea was at the time of the only, as far as I know, the only Ukrainian census that's been done there, which was 2001. And at that time, it was 58% Russians. That's over half, 58% Russian ethnicity, 24% Ukrainian, 12% of those Crimean Tatars that you're not hearing much about, and 6% other. So it certainly is a fact that the majority of the people there are ethnically Russian and therefore tend to feel more closely aligned to Russia. Now, the second part of your question, say it again exactly what you were asking.
Is there any validity, in your opinion, to the reports claiming that Vladimir Putin sent his Russian troops into the Crimea region in order to protect the ethnic Russians?
Or is that just a pretense, in other words?
I think it was pretty much a pretense. First of all, by and large, the Russians control Crimea anyway. I mean, they're the majority. They control the parliament. Got the big Navy base there and so forth. The Ukrainians, either the people in Crimea, the Ukrainians in Crimea, or the Ukrainian government in Kiev, were neither one of them were posing any threat to the majority, the 58% of Russians in Crimea. So that was a pretext. And all the people with the arms there that were wearing uniforms with no insignia, I'm a little hard-pressed to think that that was some sort of interior military unit.
Good point.
Most people think they were Russian troops with no insignia.
Are there any religious overtones to the upheavals in the Crimea and the Ukraine? Does the world need to be concerned about, for example, Muslim extremism or anti-Semitic forces taking control of these areas?
At the present time, I think the answer is definitely no. In Crimea, if you add the Russians and the Ukrainians together, that's 82% of the population. They're both Eastern Orthodox Christian. And the Crimean Tatars and a small number of descendants from the old Ottoman Turks and so forth, these people are most closely related to the Turks. And the Turks, of course, are not, by and large, extremist Muslims. And in fact, Turkey is part of NATO. So
moderate Muslims to the degree that
right.
So, involved at all.
Short answer is no, I don't think religion plays any role right now.
The big question, of course, on many people's minds here is that we've been hearing a lot of saber rattling among American leaders, European leaders, even some of the conservative forces out there talking about what should be done about the whole situation. Secretary of State Kerry has said everything is on the table right now, which of course can be code for everything up to and including potential military intervention, which some of the conservatives have actually been openly advocating for. Mm. I would like to know what your view is of the likelihood or non-likelihood that the U.S. could become militarily involved, that this could lead to another war, and what the potential consequences of military intervention by either the U.S. or Europe in this part of the world could be.
At the present time, I don't think there's much chance of any military action taking place, but an awful lot depends on how much President Putin wants to push this. You mentioned the referendum in a week, and that is just the Crimea. And they're going to vote on whether they want to secede from Ukraine and become part of Russia. I think everyone expects that will pass rather handily because, remember, 58% of the people there are Russian. And I would expect the vote, assuming that it's a valid vote and nobody is doing anything to influence it, that will break down strictly between the Russians and the others. So if you wanted to put money on the table, you'd say 58% are going to vote for it and the other 42 probably not. But it will pass. And I don't think anybody doubts that it will pass in Crimea. Now, I'm no expert on the Ukrainian constitution, but I've heard reports in the media that the Ukrainian constitution would require a vote of the entire country before any part such as Crimea could secede. If that's true, then the really important question is, what will people, meaning everybody from Putin to the West and everybody, how will they consider the vote next Monday?
Yes, and in your opinion, would the international community even recognize Crimea as a part of Russia or as an autonomous region?
Well, just finish what I was leading into, slowly into that question. What is going to matter is who considers the referendum next Monday to be binding. Is it a binding referendum? In other words, does that vote by itself authorize the Crimea to separate from Ukraine and become part of Russia? As I say, the Ukrainian constitution apparently requires a vote of the whole country. I would have trouble imagining Putin would want that to happen because I would assume, just based on the ethnicities involved and the numbers, that would not pass in the Ukraine as a whole.
So what happens? What are the ramifications?
It depends.
If the Crimeans vote and say, we want to become, we want to join Russia, and the Ukrainians vote and say, no, we don't want to let Crimea join Russia, then what?
That's a very good question. I think any answer to that is speculative, and it really depends on what Putin does. If Putin says after the referendum next Monday, that he says, okay, that's it. As far as I'm concerned, that means Crimea has left the Ukraine and is now will have a vote, which, of course, would pass, to annex Crimea into Russia. If he says that, you're going to hear a lot of howling and complaining. Would that lead to war? I doubt it very much. Nobody is in a position to move armies, not NATO, not the U.S., nobody, into Crimea for the purposes of trying to keep Crimean Peninsula part of Ukraine. The stakes are just way too high, and Putin could probably get away with that, except the United States would then say, okay, there's going to be sanctions. And I don't think anybody spelled out exactly what they would be, but we would put some sanctions into play against Russia.
So economic sanctions.
Probably economic sanctions, yeah. Now, Putin has got the card to answer that. For one thing, he's already said that it could affect their meaning Russia's cooperation with the U.S. to try and control atomic development in Iran. So far, Russia has always considered Iran an ally.
Right.
But they have kind of said, yeah, maybe we'll agree to certain terms for controlling nuclear development in Iran. He could say, nope, that's off the table. We're not there anymore. We're not going to cooperate with you. That would be a major setback for the U.S.
It's kind of echoes of the Cold War in a way here where we had
absolutely. We're definitely hearing echoes of the Cold War, yeah. And the other thing he could do, which would be even huger, would be simply to order someone to turn the valves and stop the flow of natural gas to Western Europe.
Mm.
That would be huge.
The huge stakes for Europe.
That would be huge. And I can't imagine that Putin would actually do that, but then nobody imagined he'd send 20,000 troops into Crimea either. So we just don't know how much of a risk taker he is. My feeling, this is just personally a personal opinion, is that he's willing to push things quite a ways, but there's a point at which he won't push any further.
He's shrewd, in other words.
He's shrewd. Yeah, he's very shrewd. He's certainly not dumb. And he, like every Russian leader before him and Soviet leader before him, does not want a war with the United States. He realizes, and certainly Obama and every American president realizes, that would be a total disaster for both countries.
So in your opinion, if the Crimean region were to become a part of Russia, do you believe that Russian aspirations for more land in Ukraine would cease? Or do you feel that Putin might push further into Crimea?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, that question really deserves a couple minutes to respond to because it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I really want to emphasize in this interview before it ends is that there are really two questions here. One is Crimea and what's going on there in terms of disassociating from the Ukraine and so forth. The other thing is what might happen next in terms of Ukrainian-Russian relationship. And as you started the whole interview, that's really what was behind the protests in Kiev and so forth. The thing to understand here, which has not been brought out in the media all that well, is that there's another part of Ukraine that is very heavily Russian. And that is the far eastern part of the Ukraine. If you look at the map, you think of it as about the eastern one-fifth or so, extending from the Black Sea all the way up to where you get into the Russian Republic. And the reason the Russians are there is that that is probably, in terms of heavy industry, the most important part of the Ukraine. It's what's called the Donets Basin, which is a major coal mining area. Not too far away, in an area that's somewhat more Ukrainian, is a big city called Kryvyi Rog. And near there is some of the largest iron ore deposits in the world. And those two things have made that area the Pittsburgh, if you will.
So Russia could have its eye on taking back those resources,
Union.
Ultimately.
They could, and again, this is why whether you consider the referendum in Crimea so important, because he could have a similar referendum in some of the eastern provinces of Ukraine. And I don't have access to any population data there. I'm guessing that unlike Crimea, in those areas, the Russians are not a majority. The Ukrainians probably are still a majority, but the Russians are a heavy minority.
So it might come down to voter turnout.
Maybe. Again, it's a question of how much does Putin want to push this? I kind of think that would be pushing it a little too far, but who knows? He's the one that is running the show right now. He's got all the cards, and he's playing them, and it's just a question of which cards is he going to play, and where does he stop playing?
Fascinating. Well, I know this is certainly
an issue that's of vital importance to not only many people around the world, but even many people right here in San Diego County. We do have a lot of Russian and Ukrainian immigrants in our region. I know I was at a Russian-Ukrainian restaurant just the other day where the waitress was from Russia and the owners were from the Ukraine, and they're all very concerned about what's going on. They have family still in this part of the world.
As far as Ukrainian interest, you mentioned we have some in San Diego.
Yeah.
The population of in the southern part of Saskatchewan and Manitoba in Canada is hugely Ukrainian. That's where they all came because the climate and the growing conditions there for agriculture are identical to the Ukraine.
The Ukraine is also known as the breadbasket of that part of the world. Mm-hmm. To what degree are agricultural resources important here?
They are important from the standpoint that if there's anything that's really important to the Ukrainian economy, it's agriculture. They have excellent soils. Some of the best soils in the world are in Ukraine. And just to go back to the Soviet period before it broke up, the total arable land in Ukraine was only about 15% of the USSR total, but they were producing like 25 to 30% of almost any agricultural commodity.
So it's an important strategic.
Meat, vegetables, potatoes, everything. Yeah, and so I would have to assume that they still export, just based on those numbers, that they still export food to probably into Russia and other parts around there. So yeah, the agriculture is extremely important to Ukraine.
More to the issue of the Crimean region, if Russia does allow Crimea to become a part with them, what does this mean to further Russian aspirations in reference to the Baltic states, Lithuania? Do they have any worries about further intrusions?
Yeah, without any doubt, they're worried. I would be worried right now. I just looked at some numbers and found something extremely interesting. Between World War One and the German invasion in 1940, the Baltic states were independent for 23 years. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, it is exactly 23 years to today. And right now, Russia is again looking expansionist. So yeah, I would worry a lot if I were in the Baltic republics. Having said that, I cannot imagine in a million years Putin would go in there, because the Baltic states are so closely allied now to Western Europe that you're basically talking of an attack on NATO if they were to send troops into any of the Baltic republics. And keep in mind, it's not just the Baltic republics. In 1895, under the final years of the Russian Empire, Russia also controlled Poland and Finland. And so
it was a major world power in those days. Yeah.
Yeah, the Russian Empire was bigger than the Soviet Empire. And so in addition to the Baltic republics, Finland was part of Russia for 100 years, and they fought the famous 1939 Winter War in Finland. So everybody's worried.
Thank you very much for that fascinating bit of history. We're certainly going to stay tuned, stay on this, and we greatly appreciate you taking the time to come in and educate our listeners about the very important issues unfolding in Crimea and the Ukraine, Professor.
It was my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, thank you so much, Professor, and I wish you a beautiful day.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week's Destination East County program includes a St. Patrick's Day festival, a reenactment, and a crafts fair, along with other assorted activities around East County. Celebrate Vallecito Day on Saturday, March 15th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This annual celebration at Vallecito County Park portrays frontier life in the 1860s, with reenactors portraying the arrival on horseback of weary travelers from the South Overland Trail. Leprechauns are in the park, Dos Picos Regional Park, that is. Assemble your team or hunt solo. Saturday, March 15th, the hunt begins at sunrise and continues till all 21 leprechauns are found. At Lake Marina on Saturday, March 15th at 2:30 p.m., an interpretive nature hike and ranger talk will be about native plants and the Kumeyaay Indian use of native plants. In addition, guests will learn the history of Lake Marina. This interpretive hike repeats on dates in April, May, and June. See their website at www.sdparks.org. East County Arts and Crafts Fair, a new monthly fair in El Cajon, is being held this Saturday and Sunday, March 15th and 16th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Heartland Masonic Lodge on Ballantyne Street. A new Art in the Park 2014 exhibit is on display now at Mission Trails Regional Park in the Visitors Center. This exhibit includes photography by Dana Levine, Eileen Mandel, and Dana Parnes. Also at Mission Trails Regional Park, the Foundation Concert Series is free to the public and is scheduled for 3 p.m. on the third Sunday of each month in the Visitors Center Theater, with the reception immediately following. This Sunday, March 16th, features the Caprice Strings Trio. Listeners can enjoy string sounds of violin, viola, and cello by a trio ensemble. Caprice has performed widely over the past 20 years with an extensive repertoire that embraces Baroque, classical, and contemporary works, from Bach to Mozart to Gershwin and the Beatles. The MTRP Foundation Concert Series is free to the public. All performances are held in the Visitor Center Theater. On April 6th, the San Diego Harp Society will be performing there. Tony Cummins is playing at Hooley's Irish Pub and Grill in Rancho San Diego on Friday, March 14th, from 9 p.m. to midnight. Then he'll be back on St. Patrick's Day for Hooley Fest in La Mesa on Monday, March 17th, from 5 p.m. to midnight. Hooley Fest is San Diego Premier's St. Patrick's Outdoor Music Festival. Hooley Fest will take place on Monday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, in the parking lot of La Mesa's Grossmont Center. Guests can enjoy the following talented Irish bands under the big tents: Irish legend Tony Cummins, San Diego's show band Jukebox, and American fiddle rockers Lexington Field. Guinness and Jack FM will be providing free, safe rides home within a five-mile radius. The theater production You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, a play based on the classic Peanuts cartoon characters of Charles Schulz, will be performed at Grossmont College from Thursday, March 13th through Saturday, March 22nd. The award-winning musical is full of fun and laughter with songs like The Kite, The Baseball Game, and Supper Time, and it is meant for the whole family. At the Hyde Art Gallery on the campus of Grossmont College, an Artists for Healing exhibition is being held. Nearly 100 local artists, including Grossmont College art faculty, have donated their own artwork to what is being called 100 by 100, Artists for Healing, a benefit to raise money for the American Cancer Society that takes place from 7 to 9 p.m. on Friday, March 14th, on campus. Now for a preview chock full of upcoming spring events. The Antique Automobile Club of America will be presenting a show at Summers Past Farm on Saturday, March 29th, which starts at 10:30 a.m. and goes all day. At this free outdoor event, visitors can wander among old cars of yesteryear and reminisce, and also visit the farm, which has a small cafe area and a plant market. There are two events, both coming up on Saturday, April 5th. For months, the Water Conservation Garden, or The Garden, on the campus of Cuyamaca College has been building and anticipating their newest addition, a butterfly pavilion. Dubbed the Dorcas E. Utter Butterfly Pavilion, the Water Conservation Garden invites the public to the Butterfly Festival opening on Saturday, April 5th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The festival will include tours of the pavilion, a pollinator parade with a butterfly release, a butterfly habitat plant sale, butterfly experts, booths and workshops, butterfly discovery lab, and kids' crafts, plus appearances by Ms. Smarty Plants and Miss Metamorphosis. The other event on Saturday, April 5th, is Project Wildlife's fifth annual Wildlife Baby Shower. From 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., guests will be able to see some baby animals as well as other rescued wildlife, and they can bring donations or choose a gift online for the babies through a gift registry established at Amazon.com. There will be tours of the triage center where many of Project Wildlife's volunteers work with the animals, as well as a kids' zone with games and activities for the whole family. There will also be an opportunity drawing and a wildlife bazaar for shopping. The Ramona Bluegrass and Old West Fest is coming up on Saturday, May 3rd and Sunday, May 4th. This two-day local East County Festival has a lineup of musicians performing on the Old West stage and also has a Civil War era camp, a saloon, mountain men, a prairie schooner, and the cowboys. Guests will be able to visit their camps to observe, talk, and learn about how life was lived in the 1700s to 1800s. That's all for this week. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is supported by our listeners and with a community enhancement grant from the Board of Supervisors of San Diego County. See you around, East County!
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. And I'm very pleased today to welcome my special guest, Marie Johnson from KNSJ. Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Miriam.
Marie is here to tell us about a very special event coming up on the 15th of March, and it's called the People's Ball. It's a big annual bash, and Marie, tell us all about it.
All right, thank you, Miriam. KNSJ and Activist San Diego are hosting the annual People's Ball. It's going to be at Balboa Park at the World Beat Center. The address is 2100 Park Boulevard. We're on the east side of Balboa Park, and we're celebrating KNSJ Community Radio, KNSJ Networking for Social Justice, one of many community stations, radio stations that have popped up across the United States in recent years.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit about the importance of community radio. And for those listeners who may not understand the difference, how is community radio different than some other types of radio that you hear out there?
Community radio is exactly what it says. It involves the community members, and we have locally produced shows, and this People's Ball on March 15th is an opportunity to meet local show hosts such as Miriam and other show hosts as we build up KNSJ with locally produced programming that reflects community voices that are not often heard on corporate media. We are an independent station, and our People's Ball on March 15th is going to have some fabulous dance music by the world-renowned Liquid Blue, which is in the Guinness World Book of Records as the most internationally traveled band.
Wow.
They have thousands and thousands of followers. Mm-hmm. Our MC is going to be John Elliott, who is well-known to the San Diego audience as well as a well-known national personality.
Fantastic. So we can bring our dancing shoes and dance the night away?
Absolutely. It's going to be fabulous dance music. And our entertainment for the evening is going to include local musicians,
nice.
Local talent, and again, an opportunity to meet our local show hosts. So if you have not already met Miriam and want to bend her ear and tell her what a great program she's been putting on and what a wonderful magazine she has, this is an opportunity to get to know her even better, as well as our other show hosts.
There you go. We're hoping to have an East County Magazine table there. So if anybody wants to sit at our table, you can let me know at editor@eastcountymagazine.org. And it's a good chance to tell us your story ideas, not just to me, but for the other hosts. If you've got maybe even an idea for a community radio show, this is your chance to come and tell the powers that be over at KNSJ all about it, right?
Yes. And KNSJ is also encouraging, again, the community to become very actively involved with the community radio station. We're developing more news. Miriam, you do a fantastic job with the news and the events that you cover, issues that are very important to people in East County. And we're developing citizen journalists and citizen reporters. But our People's Ball is a way for the community to show their support for voices that reflect what the community interests, talents, culture, diversity are.
Now, the term ball sort of implies formal wear and glitz and glamour, but this isn't really like that at all, right? So for anyone out there who may want to come, can you tell us a little bit about how do you dress and where do you get more information about this?
As a People's Ball, we want you to be comfortable, be prepared to kick off your shoes and mm-hmm. dance the evening away. There's going to be some nice humor parodies.
Comedy,
of issues that are going on.
Yeah, there's a comedy show now on Diane Jean has a comedy show on the radio, correct?
Yes, we have several comedy shows that are on that are talking about the humorous aspects, not only of general life mm-hmm. and the community in San Diego, the scene around here, but also on political, topical issues.
Right. You have Talk of the Town. That's a new show that just debuted, and that's with local hosts as well. So it's really expanding, you know, rapidly out there. So if people want to come to the People's Ball and get more information about it or even get tickets for it, Marie, where can they get that information?
Go online to knsj.org.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, I look forward to seeing you there at the People's Ball and hopefully some of our listeners as well. Marie, thank you so much for joining us today on KNSJ, Networking for Social Justice, 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Thank you, Miriam.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing New York Times bestselling author Caitlin Rother. My guest has written or co-authored 9 books, including true crime thrillers Lost Girls, Poisoned Love, Dead Reckoning, Body Parts, Twisted Triangle, and the thriller Naked Addiction. 2 of her books are inspirational memoirs about her co-authors, New York Times bestseller My Life, Deleted, and Where Hope Begins, Deadly Devotion. 3 of her books were named in the top 10 best true crime books, and 2 were in the San Diego Book Awards as finalists in 2011 and 2012. Welcome, Caitlin. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me today.
Let's start with your area of expertise, writing true crime. And actually, you're the first true crime writer who's been interviewed on this show. Tell us why true crime. What do you enjoy about it? What motivates you to write in this genre, if you want to call it a genre? And what do you find challenging or difficult about it?
Well, I was a newspaper reporter for many years, investigative reporter covering government and politics, and I kind of got to the point where I felt like these politicians were constantly giving me spin, and and it was actually kind of a nice change, and it felt less dirty to write about crime than it did about politics.
Wow.
Which is a sad statement.
Yes.
But I just see it as a very important thing to everyone, to learn how to protect yourself, to be aware of your surroundings, learn about why do people do these crimes? How do they get to be the kind of person who does such a heinous thing mm-hmm. to somebody else? And where can we see where there are flaws in the system that maybe
right.
we can fix things and change things? Went into journalism as an idealist and
right.
trying to reveal and uncover problems. And for me, this was something that I thought I could really educate people on mm-hmm. on the legal system, the criminal justice system,
right.
and you know, and to really give victims a voice and victims' families, show their mm-hmm. strength, show how they survive these things, show how an investigation is put together and how, you know, how the police work, how they think, which mm-hmm. is interesting to me and I think to other people. And then how the prosecution takes it into the courtroom, the defense strategy, and there's always, you know, justice at the end. So mm-hmm. it's...
Always?
Well, the books that I write
okay.
for the publisher that I have require conviction, so I do have that requirement, and it's for liability reasons, but I think for this genre, that's a niche genre. People want a happy ending, if you want
right.
to call it happy, but just to make sure that the criminal is convicted and goes to
right.
prison.
So it was a natural segue from journalism. And how has writing about this changed you? Has it changed you?
Well, I'm definitely more aware. I don't want to say I'm paranoid. I think there are some true crime readers who actually are scared, and they live more scared, I think, than you really want to be. And I hear people, when I talk, sometimes whisper, God, this is depressing.
Right.
But you know what? It's a part of life. And mm-hmm. I really, you know, I don't write about graphic violence. Mm-hmm. And even though there's often a sexual or psychosexual component mm-hmm. to these books, because when you write about a rapist killer, it's about power. It's not about sex, and
sure.
it's about violence. But I really come at it from a psychological standpoint mm-hmm. because that, to me, is what's interesting. It's the dynamics between the characters. It's, you know, how do these schemes get plotted out and launched? I mean, I often write about con men and con women. So I really stick to the less gruesome crimes in the first place. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at greed. I'm looking at corruption. I'm looking at, you know, often white-collar kinds of crimes. And when there are murders, I really don't want the gruesome, gory details.
So you don't sensationalize.
So I don't sensationalize because I don't want to write a book I personally wouldn't want to read. And what I read for my, you know, own enjoyment is, you know, literary fiction. Mm-hmm. And I teach narrative nonfiction. And I know it's not to everybody's taste, but I think true crime sometimes gets a bad rep that, oh, it's going to be gross and gory and gruesome, right. and I don't want to read that. Well, that's not what my books are like at all.
Okay, well, let's talk about your latest book, I'll Take Care of You, which came out 2 months ago. I understand it's about the love triangle murder of Newport Beach multi-millionaire inventor Bill McLaughlin and his fiancée, Nanette Packard, and her NFL linebacker lover, Eric Napolsky. What was it like to recreate that story in particular, and what do you believe it teaches us, if anything?
Well, I was drawn to that story because I was working on another story with the same police department and coincidentally the same prosecutor and one of the same defense attorneys.
Wow.
Who, this was an earlier book called Dead Reckoning up in Orange County in mm-hmm. Newport Beach. And they were about to arrest these Eric Napolsky and Nanette Packard, and the detective that I was on the phone with said, yeah, I'm putting this search warrant and arrest warrant together here, and we're going to go arrest them, and told me a little bit about it. I'm like, wow, that's interesting. So I followed it along and ended up, you know, a few years later going to the trials. But it was similar to this other case in that it was about greed. It was about mm-hmm. materialism and about how money really corrupts people. And Nanette Packard wanted money because she didn't have any of her own, and she wanted somebody else's money. It wasn't enough for her to go out and earn it. She needed to steal it. And I just think that our whole culture is caught up today in this materialism that
right.
has, you know, really devastated our country. I mean, and our economy is in bad shape because, I mean, it's a whole long other topic.
It's a whole other book.
But I'm just saying that's what drew me to it. She,
right.
Nanette had a lot of cosmetic surgery. She, you know, embezzled money. She pretended to be somebody else because she didn't want to be who she was. And that really kind of fascinated me. She was a mystery to me. I wanted to dig in and really find out who she was. And it was quite a challenge because she lied to everybody about who she was. So even the people who thought they knew her found out that they didn't know her at all, including her husband's.
So it's like consumerism and a fake person, really, someone who's not genuine.
She stole other people's accomplishments and pretended that they were her own. She lived with this guy, Bill McLaughlin. She met him through a singles ad for Wealthy Men Only.
Ah.
I'll take care of you if you take care of me. That's where the title of the book came from. And, you know, he answered the ad. And so he must have known at least somewhat what he was getting himself
sure.
into, but he had no idea that she was going to turn around and start writing checks and forging his name, including one for $250,000 the night before he was murdered, as one of the detectives said. Honey, in our business, that's a clue.
Yes, I would think so. Well, I know your next true crime book is scheduled for release by Kensington Pinnacle
mm-hmm.
in November 2015, and that one is about the Stephen DeMocker case out
mm-hmm.
of Prescott, Arizona. Give us a teaser, if you would, and what we can expect to enjoy or learn from that book without giving it away.
Okay. This is what just ran on Publisher's Lunch today. Her Last Breath, which may not be the eventual title, but
uh-huh.
it's the true story of a family with expensive tastes torn apart by sex addiction, blood money, manipulation, and murder, and the roller coaster legal ride to justice in a small mountain town in Arizona. And coincidentally, it again was tied back to that same book, Dead Reckoning, that I just mentioned. The victims in that case, Tom and Jackie Hawks, used to live in Prescott, Arizona, where this case takes place. And a reader of that book has started writing me and sending me news stories and saying, what do you think about this for your next book? And
wow.
The first case, it didn't work. And this one, she kept sending me these stories. And I thought, And the more stories she sent me, I said, you know what? She's right. This is really interesting. Again, it's another story about greed. Stephen DeMocker was a financial planner, and he just spent so much money that he didn't have. And his wife, I guess, put up with affair after affair after affair. She was a therapist. She thought she could help him with this sex addiction. And she sounds like just a really wonderful person, a really good person. They had two daughters. And the thing that's, I'm just starting to really get into the research, but what's really interesting to me is that his entire family is behind him, including the two daughters of the woman who was murdered. They do not believe their father did this murder. And so it's pretty interesting to me that these two girls, one was only just about 16 when this happened to her mother, that she's still stuck by her father even after he's been convicted and sentenced.
That is interesting. As a social worker, I find that very interesting.
Yeah, and the older daughter during the sentencing hearing said, you know, I really want to remember my mother, but, you know, I also think we should be talking about forgiveness today, which I thought was a really interesting, non-committal, but interesting comment. So I think there's going to be a lot of really fascinating psychological aspects to this as well. And it does follow along the same theme about money and money corrupting people.
And about seeing what we want to see.
And seeing what we want to see and how this story really was about money. I mean, it was about two life insurance policies worth $750,000. And she was murdered the day after her first alimony payment was due under a divorce that had just gone through. So it's a fascinating story. And then the other thing was there were two trials and all kinds of things that happened after the murder, after Steve DeMocker was in jail. So it's a fascinating case from a legal aspect as well.
Wow. It's a lot to take in.
I know.
Let's
imagine
talk
being in my brain right now.
Let's talk about a book that's, for me, even harder to take in because it resonates to us, I think, the most in San Diego, Lost Girls, which took us through the desperate search for two lost innocents, Chelsea King and Amber Dubois, in 2012, and about the convicted sex offender who ended their lives. I know that that book was featured on 48 Hours, Dateline, Today, Good Morning America, Nancy Grace, and Larry King Live, and it was voted number 4 in True Crime Zine, top 10 true crime books of 2012. This story, this crime, was very difficult for San Diegans. What was it like for you to pull the threads of the story and to read never-before-revealed documents on this tragic case and piece together the history of John Albert Gardner?
Well, for me, this is the most important book that I've written. I really thought hard when I started writing these books. I was a serious investigative reporter covering serious issues, and I really wanted to combat this perception that some people have that, you know, true crime is entertainment and sensationalizing violence. And like I said, my books really do not contain violence. They are about why. They answer the question why, and they get into the psychology. So to me, I saw the emotions that were tearing this county apart. I lived here during this entire case as it was unfolding when Chelsea went missing and everybody went out looking for that girl. I had a missing poster in my gym and I thought, wow, you know, that's really unusual. This 17-year-old must be something really special. And you could see it in her face. And I think everybody felt that way when they saw that picture of her. So angelic. She had so much to live for. She had such a bright future. And I was drawn in too. So I started writing about this for the Daily Beast. And I got drawn in and I wanted to know more about this John Gardner that everybody was saying must have done it. And then lo and behold, you know, they managed to arrest him very quickly, which I was also impressed with the sheriff's work. I mean, this was very commendable. So with those factors, I thought, you know, I think this is an opportunity. We don't know that much about sex offenders. We don't want to know. We think it's repulsive. We push it out of our minds. I think there's a lot of people put their hands over their ears and go, la, 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 I right. don't want to know this. Just lock them up and put it away. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine, and I don't think most people even want to try, what it must be like in their head. Why do they do this to young girls, children, and, you know, adults and teenagers like this? So I really, my goal was not to go in there and describe what he did to these girls. That was the last thing I wanted to do. What I wanted to explain was how does a sex offender get to be a sex offender? Let's use this case as a case study, really dig in, get into the family history, find out why he did what he did and who he really was. And my biggest question, and I thought to myself, if I can't answer this question, I won't do it. But if I can get to his mother, who everybody was blaming and wouldn't talk to anyone, and no media, if I can get her to talk to me about his family and the dysfunctional family theater, which I was assuming must have happened, I think it would explain a lot, and it would help people understand, and it would hopefully help us prevent something like this from happening again. Maybe I could find something out that could have been done differently the next time. Right. So that's exactly what I did. So I mm-hmm. interviewed his mother at length for months. A couple times a week, we would talk on the phone. I met with her in person for hours at a time. And I got her to basically reconstruct everything that happened. And I really think it was very interesting. And I told her, look, I'm not writing a sympathetic book about you or John Gardner. I'm not excusing his behavior. I'm not trying to rationalize his behavior. I want to explain his behavior, because I think everybody can learn from something. We can take a horrible thing and try to find something good about it. So that was my intention. And I was accused later by the victim's parents. At least Amber's mother was very upset about the book, The Kings, who I was never able to actually personally present my, you know, my reasons for writing this book, but I had to go through a representative. I wish I could have sat down with them. I tried repeatedly, and they just didn't want to cooperate. And that's absolutely their right, and I totally Sure. understand that. That's happened to me with other books. Other victims' families have been the exact opposite. They wanted to talk. They felt it was cleansing for them. It helped them process the information. It was almost therapy for them, and to feel like they were helping other people understand. So, you know, it's always different with these Yes. books, but I always try to be very sensitive, and I want to pay a tribute to the victims, because that's why we're writing these books. It's to prevent things like this from happening again.
So peeking into the mind of, and I know it's very difficult to peek into the mind, because I know that the FBI, they have profilers, it's difficult for them. So peeking into his mind, what was that like as a writer?
Well, I was a psychology major at Berkeley, and I've always been interested in writing about the mentally ill and about prisons, and I did it as a reporter at the Union Tribune for years. I covered mental health, I covered prisons, I covered jails, I covered welfare, I covered the Polinsky Center, where mm-hmm. I saw these kids neglected and abandoned and abused, and so I wanted to know what happened to him maybe as a child, and what I learned was he came from an incredibly dysfunctional family. He was born into a very dysfunctional family. Drunk and drugs father. Mother was a psychiatric nurse who had to take care of a whole bunch of dysfunctional people. Her mother had been treated for depression and had electroshock therapy. It was endless. His mother turned out to be, you know, an incest molestation victim herself as a child. She was also raped when John was, Gardner was just 4 months old. So he was born into a family of victims.
And violence.
And violence. His father beat him when he was just a baby. But, you know, there are other kids who come from homes like that who don't go out and kill people.
Sure.
He was also bipolar. His mother tried to commit suicide when he was 9 and 10 years old. He tried to commit suicide several times right before he killed Chelsea. So, I mean, he was a troubled guy. And the thing about this that I found out in my research was that he tried to get help. And there is a big problem with our system. It's one of the biggest pieces of important research that I managed to uncover. There are no beds in this county that take mentally ill people or people with substance abuse problems that will also take sex offenders. Now, he was in prison for 5 years for assaulting and molesting his 13-year-old neighbor. So when he got out and, you know, he started feeling himself disintegrating mentally, his mother saw it too, tried to get him help, took him to a psychiatrist. The doctor said, "Do you feel like you're going to kill somebody right now?" Because Gardner said, "Well, I think I could be a 5150, meaning
right.
you could help hurt yourself or others." And the doctor said, "Do you feel like killing someone right now?" He said, "No." And he goes, "Well, here, take these two vials of medication." And guess what? They were the wrong medication. They made his mania even worse, escalated. So he's running around that lake, you know, trying to walk it off. And he told me what was in his head at the time, and I don't know that I want to go into it now. You can read the book. But
right.
I didn't want to know what he did to them other than what was in the plea bargain that was public, two sentences. But just, you know, what was he thinking before? Why did he do what he did? And how did he feel afterwards? And what could we learn from that?
Sure. And it sounds like, to wrap that up, that the what we can also glean from a story like this is perhaps some flaws in the system that
Absolutely.
We can address. Okay, well, you've written so many books that are heartbreaking and mind-bending, and you've described a few of them here. Tell us a little bit about your writing routines and your passions. What makes Caitlin Roth of the Writer tick, and how do you stay balanced in your own life?
Well, these books can get dark.
Yes.
So I wrote a bunch of them quickly in a row, and I started realizing that what I really needed to do was to alternate with other types of books. So I started looking for, you know, other ways to keep myself balanced, because it can get very depressing and, mm-hmm. and dark and difficult, you know, to do that every day. And so I, you know, started co-authoring memoirs with other people, and My Life Deleted, for example, which got onto the New York Times bestseller list, was a great change for me. It was not about crime. It was about a medical story and a love story.
A love story, very different.
A psychological story about, you know, this guy who fell down, hit his head, lost his entire memory in just a couple hours. It was completely gone, and how he rebuilt his life and relearned the world and who he wanted to be. So it was kind of a metaphysical book as well.
Inspiring.
Inspiring. And I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, you know, I teach, I coach other writers who want to break in, and I help them with book proposals. I critique their work. I help them shape their books. And I teach narrative nonfiction, both at UCSD Extension and San Diego mm-hmm. Writers, Inc. And I really enjoy that. And mm-hmm. I enjoy the one-on-one working with people who are trying to break in. And they're so excited, and they're so grateful. And when they're engaged, it makes me happy. You know, I go and I speak to groups also mm-hmm. and share my knowledge and experience, and I really enjoy that. I swim at the Cove, long distance swimming, and I've started singing with my boyfriend, and we're practicing, and that's a whole other thing that's pretty fun too.
So you sound like you really make an effort to stay active and balanced and really enjoy life so that you can keep that perspective.
Absolutely.
Well, it has been wonderful talking with you, Caitlin. Thank you so much for spending so much time discussing your work.
Well, I really appreciate you inviting me here. Thank you.
If you'd like more information on Caitlin Rother's books, please visit her website at www.caitlinrother.com. And I'm going to spell that. It's CaitlinRother. CaitlinRother.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Brian Boykel, Kevin McLeod, and Royalty Free Music. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.